Hey everybody, welcome to another time-hopping episode of Songs in the Key of X. I am your lovable and nutritious host, Jeffrey X. Martin of Biff Pam Pop. Over the last two seasons, we've covered my favorite songs from the year I was born all the way up through the 1970s. Now it's time to pull the time machine out of the garage, where it's been sitting underneath a tarp for the last couple of years, and take a jaunt back to 1980. Man, what an important year for music. I was 11 years old, really coming into my own as far as musical tastes and inclinations. Meanwhile, new wave and synth pop were slowly displacing British hardcore punk. American hardcore wasn't really in its infancy, but the more famous bands hadn't found prominence yet. 1980 is such a big year, I've decided to divide this journey into two separate parts. You know, I like to put the songs in ascending order, but my favorite song of 1980 is actually a tie. So the number one song on this episode and the number one song in the final episode for 1980 are both number one because I'm wishy-washy and can't make a decision to save my life. So let's kick off our celebration with this episode's number five. Christine. Strawberry girl, Christine. Banana split lady, Christine. The strawberry girl, Christine. Banana split lady. From the album Kaleidoscope, that is Susie and the Banshees with Christine. Kaleidoscope saw Susie and the Banshees begin to lean heavily into an art pop style that came to be associated with the burgeoning goth movement of the time. Susie Sue became the prototype spooky chick of the decade, with her thick black eye makeup and a fashion sense that could only be described as witchy. I mean, not in a Stevie Nicks way, but, you know, in a Susie Sue way. Their third release, Kaleidoscope, was the band's biggest hit to date, hitting number 5 on the UK charts. Dark and brooding and dipping its cute little toes into neo-psychedelia, Susie and the Banshees became one of the most influential bands of the 1980s. Christine is based on the true story of a woman named Christine Costner Sizemore, who had dissociative identity disorder. Her separate personalities, such as the banana split lady and the strawberry girl, are mentioned in the song. It's a creepy little track, musical instruments playing less than whole chords, giving the whole thing a disjointed feel. The only thing really grounding the song is Susie's voice, which I guess is Alpha Susie? Because everything else jabs and pokes the listener in a way that hurts, but you like it, don't you? Number 4. If looks could kill, they probably will. In games without frontiers, war without tears. If looks could kill, they probably will. In games without frontiers, war without tears. Games without frontiers, war without tears. After Peter Gabriel left Genesis in 1975, he released a series of 4 solo albums, all of which he named after himself, which made alphabetization real easy. Games Without Frontiers is from Gabriel's 3rd solo album, known as Melt, because of the cover art that features Gabriel's skin sliding off of his face. Games Without Frontiers compares war to a group of children playing games. In fact, there's a television show called Games Without Borders, very popular in Europe, where teams from different towns compete against each other in wacky races and the like. The lyrics garnered a small bit of controversy, with lines like Adolf builds a bonfire, Enrico plays in it, referencing Adolf Hitler and Enrico Fermi, the man who created the world's first nuclear reactor. Gabriel and guest vocalist Kate Bush sing the phrase Je sans frontières in the song, and for the longest time I didn't know that was French for Games Without Frontiers. Thought it was English. I had a hell of a time trying to understand what they were saying. Eventually, I decided they were singing "She's So Funky, Yeah," which didn't make a lick of sense, but I couldn't figure anything else out. Look, we didn't have the internet back then, so I couldn't just look up information. Anyway, it's a great song. Sparse, minimal, featuring some of the spookiest whistling ever recorded. And also, apparently, French. Number 3. It's the title track from the debut album by Bauhaus, In the Flat Field. Gothity, gothity, goth, goth, goth. Bauhaus had already released their classic song, Bela Lugosi's Dead, as a single on the first album. Bauhaus cemented their image as pretty, skinny boys playing frightening music, heavy on the reverb and creating a vibe all of its own, inspired equally by the German Bauhaus art movement and the glam rock of the 1970s, Bauhaus was pioneers in the gothic rock genre. Lead singer Peter Murphy weighed about 30 pounds, soaking wet, but he wailed and screamed all over In the Flat Field, while guitarist Daniel Ash made demons fly out of his guitar strings in a paroxysm that was less music, more exorcism. Gorgeous in its hopelessness, riveting in its incantation, In the Flat Field is a stunning listen, a subway trip to the necropolis, a clearing surrounded by dead black trees. It's style over substance, for sure, but my gods, what style it has. Number 2. The inimitable sounds of Talking Heads with Once in a Lifetime from the band's fourth studio album, Remain in Light. Both quirky and ominous, Once in a Lifetime features an odd time signature, a keyboard line that drones like a warning bell that won't stop ringing, and the halting vocals of David Byrne. He talks to you like an automated therapist, encouraging you to stop everything and ask yourself, how did I get here? It's an incredible call for clarity in a strange medium. The music seems to be wobbling on stilts, a lack of balance, setting up a dichotomy for the introspectively inspirational lyrics. Intentionally, the song doesn't find solid footing until the last minute, when Byrne reminds us that time isn't holding us, time isn't after us. It's a remarkably freeing sentiment, almost revelatory in its simplicity. That may be the best description of Once in a Lifetime. Simple beats and lines thrown together in a way that doesn't seem like they could possibly work as a singular unit until they do. And we are subtly reminded that we also are strange and simple things, thought processes and physical forms combined in a dangerously beautiful way. Number 1. Of a relationship in the last stages of decay and separation, you would find Love Will Tear Us Apart by Joy Division. The song may be the finest examination of love's dissolution ever put to music. The lyrics, written by Joy Division singer Ian Curtis, detail his failing marriage to wife Deborah Woodruff. Curtis was dealing with major issues at the time. His star was rising, but he still kept a day job. Curtis had epilepsy, and he dealt with the ramifications of that. He was terrified of having an epileptic seizure on stage. All of those things weighed on Curtis, as did his relationship with music promoter Annick Honoré. Sometimes things get so far away from you that you can't figure out what to do next. The stutter-step drumming of Stephen Morris gives the song an urgency, like trying to step onto an elevator while the door's closing. Peter Hook's trademark high-octave bass lines secure the song's melody, while Bernard Sumner's whispering keyboards give the song a questioning feel. But it's Curtis's vocal delivery that makes Love Will Tear Us Apart a classic. With this heavy Macclesfield accent, Curtis practically slides his way through the song, asking pointed questions about love and the responsibility of marriage, how it can fall apart, who should take the blame, and the flat observation that something so good just can't function no more. Look, if you've been through a divorce, a breakup, Curtis is singing on your behalf. It was something he understood. Love Will Tear Us Apart was released 1 month after Curtis's self-removal from the planet. Joy Division was set to embark on their first U.S. tour before he died. The words Love Will Tear Us Apart are engraved on Curtis's grave marker. In a few weeks, I'll return with the conclusion of this 1980 show, certainly one of my favorite years in music. If you are a Spotify user, I keep a running playlist of the songs that I use on this show. Do a search for BBP, Songs in the Key of X, and feel free, if not invited, to follow along. Speaking of BBP, please explore the rest of the site. You'll find articles about video games, music, movies, action figures, professional wrestling. We have a tremendous staff of writers, just a bunch of folks who love what they cover and cover what they love. Take a look around. The Summer of X continues next week with another episode of Songs in the Key of X, and I hope you'll come back for that one. I'm going to go park this time machine. My name is Jeffrey X. Martin. You've been listening to Songs in the Key of X, and until next time...